Hello, welcome to the PC Gamer UK podcast. I'm Sam Roberts. I'm joined today by
Philip Orr.
Phil Savage.
Let's talk about some PC games, lads. Sorry, I thought we could use lads as a kind of general term these days. Can you do that if it's ironic?
Not so much, I'd say.
Well, there you go. I've been called out already. We're only like 30 seconds into the podcast.
Yeah, we launched straight into the social issues of the day.
How do you feel about lads, boys with an I?
Problematic.
Boys. Thick boys with a C and boys with an I.
With a double C.
Two Cs.
That's it, two Cs. Yes, two Cs.
Good luck sub-editing that one. Turn of phrase.
Okay, good. Well, rather than dwell on that, I'm just going to move straight into the games. And we're going to talk about Beyond Good and Evil, first of all. The 2003 nice Ubisoft game with a photographer and some talking pigs and lots of nature photography that Pip has been playing for reasons related to work, right?
Well, it's because there was recently some more footage of Beyond Good and Evil 2, the multi-developmental thing that has spanned a decade and a bit now.
Yeah.
So now currently a prequel that looks kind of like an MMO, but I thought it was as good a time as any to check out the game, what it is prequeling.
Yes.
And because it comes up quite a lot, because my high gaming watermark of all time is obviously Pokemon Snap. And
why would we think anything different?
Why haven't they made a new one of those? Do you think the Switch would be perfect for
that?
Should I have not got you started?
No. But my
welcome
theory
to the PC Gamer podcast.
My theory / prediction a few years ago was that they should resurrect Pokemon Snap, but as an AR game where you photograph Pokemon out in the field.
Yes.
And that sort of happened to some extent with Pokemon Go.
Right, yeah.
Right? So I'm not sure whether anyone would have paid out on that if I had put it as a bet in any fine betting establishment.
Right, yes.
So this is much like when I predicted that Beyonce would name her child Ivy, but the middle name was Ivy, so I'm not sure whether I would have got any money for that.
Maybe half the winnings? I don't know.
I'm not sure that's
I'm still pretty impressed, but yeah.
Thanks. Anyway, that's all by the by, because people would then say, oh, but have you played Beyond Good and Evil? Because that has photography of a kind in there, because, you know, one of the ways that you earn, I don't know, science, money, something, credits, is by taking photos of any species that you observe in your surroundings and wanging it away to some faraway person for a database, I believe.
Mm.
The photos are terrible, but, you know, it's fine.
That's not the point.
As in, your photos are terrible, or the game is just inevitably making you take bad photos.
So as in, I remember with Pokemon Snap, I actually spent time lining up shots, and for that to be a rewarding experience, because it would then show you a thing, you know, with a kind of carefully curated, or, you know, to a certain extent, composition, right? Whereas this is very much like, well, the thing, you know, the viewfinder thing went green, which meant the thing was in the centre of the photo.
Yeah.
And regardless of the fact that all you see is like a smudge of greeny blue because it's so low res, like that counts as the photo. So I was kind of, I think I was hoping for a bit more of a kind of, that you could actually see what you had taken a picture of, rather than it being essentially a money-making, like, mini-game, if that makes sense. I was kind of hoping that some element of photography, even if it didn't influence the credits or anything, and it was only for your own amusement, I was kind of hoping for a little bit more on that front.
Yeah, weirdly, Bioshock's slightly better for that, isn't it?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
Although, does that reward, like, you for getting specific compositions or anything? Because isn't it just,
it's just making
it
sure
just recognises the asset is in front of the viewfinder, I suppose.
That's true, but then I'm pretty sure it ranks you according to the quality of the
potentially
photo.
Yeah.
Perhaps I'm misremembering.
It might not be the quality that I think there's something in there about you get more points if it's like if the character is in combat or whatever, because I guess the point being you can actually study it based on what its attack patterns are or something.
Which is at least slightly more in-depth.
Yeah.
Is this the first Bioshock?
Yes.
So I've actually just started that as well.
Okay, cool.
So I think it's that thing, though, of, like, even if it's nothing to do with the actual, I guess, scoring system within a photography minigame, I think I just want the actual experience of it to be slightly more, like, I don't know, just more than just a token, like, did you get a green you know,
yeah, it's a very point binary system, yeah, isn't it?
Although I do remember sitting there absolutely screaming at Professor Oak for not recognising that my current picture of Charmander was a million times better than the previous one that he liked, because there was more than one Charmander.
Well, you're taking one that's like a Renaissance painting of like an Electabuzz sort of lying down, like three Voltorbs and like Articuno like flying over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're just kind of like, what, this is just the worst. So yeah, he doesn't have any sense of aesthetic appreciation. It's always just like, well, is there more than one of them? Brilliant. Great. How big is it? You know.
Not to dwell too much on Pokemon Snap, this being a PC game.
Clearly
podcast,
we're going to.
They're pretty sure the main font in that game is Comic Sans, and I could never forgive it for that.
I still, like, did I tell you that there's that part, you know, the incidental music that plays when you go see Professor Oak, and it's Don't You by the Pussycat Dolls.
Yeah, you did, and yeah. I would say it ruined that song by the Pussycat Dolls, but I never thought it was good.
No, and in case you don't know, the song that's the music from Pokemon Snap. But yeah, you'd be forgiven for thinking, oh, she just did an absolutely amazing rendition of the Pussycat Dolls. I couldn't tell that this wasn't the radio.
Yes, it's pretty good, yeah. We talked about that on Slack for at least 10 minutes. It was good. All right, so do you have any more thoughts about Beyond Good and Evil that aren't related to Pokemon Snap, Pip?
And before that, maybe we should add the disclaimer that we have just done a deadline, so that's why this is all happening.
Yeah, I can't believe you're in the office on deadline, but there's a reason for that, isn't there? It's because it's a deadline that doesn't end this week.
Yeah, I think we began being on deadline at least in 2007, and it's still happening. Don't know how, don't know why. This is just how we live now.
Amazing scenes.
I think it's odd going back to that era of gaming, just because like it feels so, I guess, part of that almost N64 kind of
era of
gaming in some ways.
It's a bit closer to being a kind of like 3D mascot game than maybe people would think. You know what I mean? Like
that
sort of thing.
Thinking, and then but also there's like little things that we've sort of ironed out in the meantime, like, you know, saving from the main menu or something, whereas this is very much you have to find a terminal and insert a disc and then ask it to save for you, you know.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, it's enfolded into the conceit of the game, I guess, but it's still a clunky thing that I haven't had to do for a billion years, it feels like. So it's kind of interesting to almost like have to adopt an older mindset for play.
Well, it's quite clunky in some ways, like the combat and,
oh god, the camera angles at points. It's just like, you know, you'll try and move forward and then suddenly it'll switch to a completely different camera angle, but you'll still be on the control system for the previous one. So you'll just end up switching back and forth between these two equally unhelpful angles while you try and just go round a corner.
Does it do fixed camera angles in places then?
Yeah, it's been when I was on the like the hover boat thing.
Oh, right,
so
yeah,
when you're
trying
to exit a port area, it then sort of suddenly switches as you're, you know, trying to exit through a tunnel, that kind of thing. And then you sort of crash into a wall because you're still trying to do the angle in the previous thing.
So when it comes to that game, I always suspected its reputation was built more on its world and its characters more than the game itself, which is just good, from what I recall. And I would imagine that's why the sequel is such an unusual step away from that, because the kind of game that Beyond Good and Evil was, no one really makes now in that same form. You know, like, so, I mean, admittedly, it's a bit abstract becoming some kind of spaceship MMO thing.
It looks like it, doesn't it? I think they've kind of said, or I think the implication is that it isn't an MMO, but from what I've seen, I don't understand why it isn't. Or why it isn't like the kind of Destiny-esque kind of dipping in and out of co-op / single player / you know, sort of shared worldy kind of.
Yeah, it's a little bit unclear, isn't it?
Playgroundy thing.
I sort of think the alternate route would have been like it becomes a typical modern Ubisoft open world game where there's stuff. I don't want to be too reductive, actually, because people, the Watch Dogs 2 and Assassin's Creed Origins seem to be very high on people's.
They're well liked, but they are just offshoots of that same central idea.
They slightly more refined, though.
They've got a template, but they kind of try and filter it off into a more specific direction. But, like, inherently, like, Watch Dogs and Assassin's Creed both do very similar things.
Yeah.
I mean, this, I guess this is trying to sort of marry that up a bit with the other kind of half of Ubisoft, which is things like Rainbow Six and For Honor and that, where there's like this ongoing multiplayer thing.
Yeah.
This ongoing, persistent multiplayer thing, because they seem to have had quite a lot of success with things like Rainbow Six, where just like having this one game that they update over and over again, and it's doing well for them.
It does look like, from that footage and what they were saying, that it's a bit like, it's a game where you and your friends can travel around in spaceships together doing stuff. Like, you showed the characters like jumping between them.
Pirate ships and, you know, like, it seemed to have, and No Man's Sky has been invoked quite a lot in that sense of, like, you know, you are wandering around, bimbling around, doing your thing, and then you can kind of seamlessly, you know, reach a ship and get into that, and then zoom off and, you know, armada with your friends and that kind of thing. But I don't, it's so hard to tell without actually playing it, like, what that feels like and whether the thing that you've been presented with in video form is.
Yes. When they first introduced it, I thought it looked like, okay, I'm not going to play that for 5 to 10 years, and I bet when I do, it will be nothing like this. But they are showing regular video updates on, well, this is the combat system, that's how that's coming together.
And,
like, I don't think you'd be transparent like that unless you were intending to actually release this thing, you know, in our adult lives. Like,
it's weird because there's a couple of things tied into that, and one is that it's such a jarring prospect if you try and view it in any way the same canon as the first game, because of just, you know, how different they are aesthetically, or, like, how, you know, everything that's changed in the last, you know, 15 years. And so I wonder whether the fact that it was in development hell for so long just means that all of the things, if it had become a successful franchise, like anything else, it would have gradually shed those older ideas and become, you know, any one of the modern templates that we have for gaming. But because it hasn't, it just feels like such a stark contrast. We don't have any of the in-between steps, because they probably existed but were always behind closed doors, or a prospect that wasn't being talked about.
We were talking about this earlier, about the version they showed at UB Days 2008, I think, where this just footage of, like, quite a high-end, realistic-looking sandy world, and Jade just jumping through windows and moving through environments, and it certainly looked like at least a vertical slice had been made for that game, whatever that was going to be.
I think the thing that I am looking at with a bit of a kind of side eye, I guess, is going on the official website. There is a lot of the developers asking its fan community what they want, if you see what I mean. And to me, that's a bit of a red flag in terms of, is this just going to be a committee-led... I mean, you know, obviously you expect the developers to have, you know, final say, and to, you know, only take on board the things that are useful to them. But, like, just the sheer volume of, oh, what do you want to see in this game? That concerns me more than anything, because it's kind of like, is it that they have this basic shape of a game and now they're not sure how to even flesh it out, so they might as well cater to super fans? Or is it that they have a plan and this is more just to add touches to it? Like, I'm a bit...
Like, if they're designing a combat system, like, that must be... They must be in a... I don't know, some way along, I would assume. Like, unless it looked, those animations look reasonably far along. It didn't look like a prototype. I don't know, maybe we'll find out more at E3. I guess we're not far off that now, so who knows. But are you concerned off the back of that then?
I think it's not I wouldn't say concerned, because that sounds like it's too... that's too strong for the feeling that it is. It's more just, I think it's a reservation, because I don't know enough about the project to be able to balance that with, oh, but I know that they're doing this, or that, you know, because of, the other thing is that because it's been in development for such a long time and presumably in so many varied forms, you know, you sort of, you wonder whether it's accreted so much stuff that it's hard to edit down or hard to lose things that were enjoyed from previous builds, or I don't even know how you shrug off the baggage it's accumulated until this point and make a fresh game.
Yes. Yeah, interesting. Phil, do you have any thoughts on Beyond Good and Evil 2? Like, what do you think of what they've shown so far?
I mean, I don't know if I'm interested in it as somebody who enjoyed Beyond Good and Evil 1, but, you know, sweary monkeys in space, I can get on board with that.
And yeah. I suppose, like, it does look like it can be from the same universe, even if it's very offbeat.
It does have talking animals, yes.
There was some quite cool footage of the characters jumping between the different spaceships as well. And I thought that
you
that's
get, like, a jetpack as well, so yeah, you can boost.
I love,
like,
the idea of that sort of thing. So are there mini games that really do that sort of thing, kind of knockabout co-op sort of space adventures? I mean, Elite obviously does, like, co-op space stuff, but it's not like you get out of the ship and your jetpack and fly to a buddy.
No, yeah, and it's very dry. Very dry.
Yeah.
It's, you know, because there are sort of space multiplayer options, like there's Astroneer and things like that, and there's
Space Engineers.
Yeah, that's the one. And I think all of them have the capacity for silly things happening if you play with...
Oh, yeah, Space Engineers certainly does.
Exactly.
Even if 30 minutes of it can be spent in a meeting.
So, yeah, I think there are options, but I think maybe none is springing to mind of the kind of movement or the kind of, like, I guess, capering.
Yeah.
Or how to have the budget of a...
I mean,
Ubisoft
Destiny
game.
Has,
yeah,
you know, a bunch of... Or did have. I haven't played two enough with other people to have a sense of that. But that's more in the sense of just it's a shooter. You don't... You know, like, there's the...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And stuff, but it's not...
Amount of interactions is much narrower.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's like, latent interest in the idea of... I mean, Ubisoft is very good at creating worlds that have... just a bunch of things that can happen to you and just giving you a lot of tools to think through a problem.
Yeah.
And, like, randomly we dipped into Watch Dogs 2 co-op, like, PvE stuff. A lot of Watch Dogs 2 four-player co-op, at least. This stuff they added, like, long after the game was released.
Didn't you say it was a bit disappointing versus the two-player co-op?
Well, so the two-player co-op, you can just drop into the world and muck about and...
Can you do that with four people?
You do drop into the world and muck about. It's just there's specific things, activities for four people, where I think the two-player stuff is a lot more open and better integrated with the campaign itself.
Yeah.
Whereas there are just, like, a couple of different modes that you can do, and most of them are PvP-based, which we weren't particularly interested in, but they did have, like, a couple of, here's a four-player mission, there's one where you have to take down a robot, and the robot has lots of defense mechanisms, so it became a bit of a puzzle, because we had to figure out, okay, this person has to do this thing, and this person has to do this thing, and then, you know, you need a person, like, just killing the waves of people who are also trying to...
Yeah.
Shoot you down.
And obviously Wildlands is a similar deal of, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wildlands has a similar thing, although, again, that is more... That feels more shooter-focused. I mean, it's not as much as Destiny. It's not like a pure FPS or anything, and it does have a few tools, but it's inherently less wacky to an extent.
Yeah.
And so Watch Dogs 2's tone is... feels quite well-balanced for that kind of hijinks. So certainly if they were taking that kind of, you know, tone and variety and applying it to a full co-op thing, and also it's in space and it's massive, then sure, yeah.
I wonder if they'll have to... Well, I mean, it's such a different theme.
Yes.
But Red Dead Redemption 2, if that gets announced for PC, and if, you know, multiplayer happens, certainly in the way of something like GTA,
yeah,
like that might be a worry for any other game that is trying to get you to multiplay with friends, especially depending on a price tag or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially if they can get that to market.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that'll be huge, but I don't know. There just seems to be, like, a big hunger for that kind of multiplayer experience.
Yeah.
That kind of not full, you know, Fortnite-esque random matchmaking lobbies or anything, but, you know, persistent, get together with some friends and have a few nights. Like, that's how I spend most weekends now. Like, one night each week just playing something.
Freeform romps.
Yes, and like Monster Hunter World is very good for that, and does that mean that would be a great option when...
Does that have persistent elements then?
Weekly
challenges and stuff like that as well. It's have weekly challenges and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's got weekly challenges and things, and obviously it's full RPG progression, yeah. And it's all about collecting. It's a very grind-heavy game, and it's mostly about just making sure you get the monster parts to craft the good armor that you like.
Yeah.
And so it's really good for just sort of getting together and going, well, okay, is there anything you need to do to progress the campaign? No, okay, well, should we just go and fight this lizard for a bit?
Because that's why we used to do Destiny as well.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It really nicely fits into that space. That'll be a good option. And it just seems like, I don't know, there was a point where that kind of, oh, we're focusing on multiplayer would be really off-putting for me. That, you know, there's plenty of people who are disappointed that we didn't get GTA 5 DLC as opposed to just more online stuff, yeah. And that's where the focus is. But like, I'm just appreciating that having that kind of space to play with friends without committing to something to the extent that you would with, for instance, an MMO. Because I think that's where I found those social interactions before, was like either MMOs or just straight up multiplayer shooters, and like, you know, shooters were perhaps a little too
disposable.
Incidental and disposable, yeah. Whereas an MMO was too big of a commitment after a while,
yeah.
So yeah, there's a nice middle ground there. But it's possible that eventually everyone will kind of find the one that really pleases them, be it Red Dead Redemption or Monster Division Hunter 2. Or Destiny if they ever kind of fix it up,
or
Division 2. That's the one that the Division 1 seemed to really take off on PC to that extent, I think, because, you know, PC never got Destiny 1, so
yeah,
Ubisoft had sort of a bit of an own goal, you know, an open goal there to just step in.
I think the only reason that I was sort of concerned about GTA, or about Red Dead, potentially, I think, is that, like, because that feels like it's a known thing that is coming out, whereas I think it's really easy to still feel like worried that Beyond Good and Evil 2 won't actually manage to set a release date or something, and I think the idea of other games with successful models appearing, I think that just feeds into that slight concern, because it's that thing of, oh, are you going to see a thing that maybe you could do and then like go, okay, well, how do we, you know, and that's maybe me not being fair to the devs, but I think it's one of the things that when something has been in development in various forms for so long, you start getting a bit antsy about like, is this like,
well, they suddenly decide to just go like, oh, well, the trend's going this way now, so let's turn it into a battle royale.
Yeah, because I think unless you work at the thing, it's hard to know where some of the decisions are being made or where some of the delays creep in, and so you're kind of like, okay.
Yeah. You would, this is obviously speculation, but you would think that the existence of a Beyond Good and Evil 2 at all would be, the questions that would be asked are, like, how is this a contemporary game that will engage players away from what the first game was. Why is Ubisoft making it now? Like, those two things fit together in the form of, well, like you say, it's got the potential to be a live game, and you know, show people interesting open worlds and offer the potential.
They're talking a lot about like the, it seems like they're talking quite a bit about what, you know, what the multiplayer potential of it is. It could also just be a very strong single player game. That it could just be that, you know, you will get a very satisfying experience if you don't decide to team up with people.
Yeah, I'm hopeful we'll learn more E3. Yeah. You would think so, wouldn't you? Like, if they're doing dev diaries and stuff, you would think maybe it'd make an appearance there.
Yeah, you'd hope. And also, like, a more positive reading of the questions that they're asking on the blog is that, you know, they are trying to answer those questions and make sure that it fits into the current, like, landscape.
They might have some kind of, like, alpha thing in mind, because they have, like, a sign-up service to sign up to be a space chimp or something like that.
Space monkey or something? That's space...
Something like that. All that to look forward to. Speaking then of live experiences, Phil, let's talk about Destiny 2.
That's Destiny 2.
You have been playing this again after... You're a bit of a lapsed player these days, aren't you?
Yeah, Monster Hunter was partially responsible. Actually, a lot of things were responsible. So Destiny 1 was very much me and Tom Senior's weekend game of choice.
After a few wines,
a couple of drinks, yeah, and then straight back and be bad at Crucible because we were too drunk to shoot the guns good. And then, Destiny 2 is an interesting game. I think I like it more than most people because a lot of what the community gets angry about doesn't really bother me. Again, partially because a lot of how I play it was I'll dip in once a week as opposed to having to play it every couple of days, or, you know, so there not being this robust end game isn't necessarily a deal breaker for me. Destiny 2, if anything, Bungie respect what that game is to sort of appeal more to how I was playing it, which is you essentially get a checklist of things to do each week and you can just go in, and as long as you're doing some of that checklist, you're going to get much more powerful stuff. The problem only comes if you've done that checklist and you still want to play Destiny 2, and then there's much fewer opportunities to actually progress your level or get stuff that will benefit you in any way. Mm. And that's just one of many problems that community has. Like, I don't want to make out that, you know, it's people being entitled or complaining or anything, because I think there are some legitimate issues there.
I'm sure that if you want to know what they are, Tim could talk about them on the US podcast.
It's such a different way of playing Destiny, like you were saying, because I remember when Destiny 2 first came out and Tim was talking about the end game problems, and I was kind of like, but I can't even imagine being a player who has reached end game within the time scale that we're talking about. So, like, you know, that's just such an alien way of playing that game to me that I was just unable to... I was kind of like, I don't think I'm going to have the same problem.
So where are you at with it now then, Phil?
So, we drifted away and played a bunch of other things, mostly Monster Hunter, a bit of everybody's golf.
Yeah. PC could really do with a golf game like that, couldn't it?
Yeah, it's got a couple, hasn't it? Like, there was one Andy quite liked, if I remember. The Golf Club, maybe?
Oh, yeah. But that was kind of more... That looked a bit more dad.
They all...
Lee Carvello's Putting Challenge.
They're all much more simmy in their presentation and
There's
style.
A golf thing. Did that come to PC?
Yes, it did. I think that's on Steam now.
A faithful golfing simulator.
It's not multiplayer, though, so...
Oh, is that the one that's 2D?
There are also quite a few. If you do a little tour around Itch.io, there's quite a lot of just like little weird golf games. Again, not multiplayer, but it's kind of interesting to check out what people have done with that basic physics.
And the best golf game of all time, of course, is Monkey Golf in Super Monkey Ball, which never came to PC.
So good.
All the mini games in that game were amazing. They should have been their own games.
We should have just set up a GameCube/N64 fan cast, I think.
Yeah, it's going that way, isn't it?
Yeah.
I do play all my games on PC, more or less. So, like, I don't know how these keep coming up, to be honest. Alright, so, yes, back to Destiny then, Phil. What happened then?
So the reason we sort of came back was because Bungie seemed to recognise how angry its player base was almost consistently, and just started coming up with various roadmap features designed to fix what it and the community saw as a lot of the problems. Mm. Part of that was rebalancing a lot of the weapons and just doing, you know, the big meta pass that you do with these things. Part of which is like speeding up the rate at which you recharge grenades and that sort of thing, which is a nice tweak because it was very slow originally, which kind of put a dampener on like a lot of the moment-to-moment enjoyable interactions you can have in that. Mm. It's nice to, you know, shoot a gun, but sometimes you want to sort of wave your hands at a person and then they die from too much electric.
Yes. I think the supers took forever to charge, from what I remember.
Supers took a lot longer to charge as well, and that you could really feel that, especially if you were just doing strikes and like the PvE stuff, because there was really no need to hold off on supers in the same way.
I think they said something like it was about making them feel more monumental when you used them, but it actually just ended up feeling like you didn't have enough special moments, or like moments of feeling powerful or being able to change things meaningfully.
It also meant that, you know, you'd often be in situations where you're like, oh, I've got my super, but I shouldn't use it now, because if I use it now, I'll be screwed, you know, in 5 minutes' time when I'll definitely need it. And
it kind of felt like they wanted to encourage strategic thinking, which is interesting, but in a game where that didn't feel like it fitted, and especially if people were coming over from the original Destiny, it's kind of like, well, you've just messed with the cadence of a thing I like.
You just feel less powerful, and it's like, I mean, how strategic can you get when you're space wizards?
Okay.
And another change is they have... So one of my bigger problems with Destiny 2 was that they changed multiplayer from being 6v6 rounds to being 4v4.
Okay.
Which, it made multiplayer matches a lot slower as well. Like, you went from the first game where almost every multiplayer game would finish because a team hit the point limit, to a system where most rounds went the full 10 minutes and it was just a case of you ran out of time and then whoever had the most points would win because you hadn't hit that point limit. And that's just sort of, I don't know, changed the pace of it in a way that was kind of annoying. Also, 4 is just an aggravating number of people to get together, annoying a number of friends to get together in a game where every other activity is either 3 or 6 people.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what didn't really make sense to me.
Were the maps smaller for the 4v4? Because I remember them being a bit, but they didn't feel small enough
to
still be snappy.
That's pretty much it. And also, they introduced a bunch of sort of reskinned versions of old maps anyway, which are like... But well, no, these are definitely designed for 6 people.
Yeah, okay. Weird.
So their kind of monthly event thing, Iron Banner... has recently started doing 6v6 multiplayer, and it'll run for about, I think it runs for 1 week every month, usually the first week of every month, and so we kind of went back just to check that out and see what it felt like having a 6v6 competition in that game, and the answer was better than the 4v4.
Makes you wonder why they even did that to begin with. Very strange.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly why they pitched it in the first place.
They were like they were nice and busy. Crucible was nice and busy in Destiny 1. Like, it was nothing wrong with the size of the maps or the amount of people within them.
I loved Crucible. That's where I spent the majority of my time, to be honest. Yeah. Because it was just so much fun to pick up and play, and you know, and 6 enemies meant that you had quite a lot of opportunities for at least getting a kill, even if you were doing really badly.
There, right? I mean, there was always something happening. It was much less about teams of 4 running around together. Like, Destiny always wanted you to work together as a team, but people had opportunities to break off and do things. And it was, you know, when you're 6 people running around, you do just break off naturally because you get distracted by something, and then, you know, the other team can get you and stuff. And yeah, it just had a much better flow to it. And I think that's largely the case in Iron Banner again. It has a better flow to it than the 4v4. And there are some things that probably still need ironing out, partially around ammo and the ammo changes they've made, which, I mean, it's like an economic difference that's almost too tedious for me to want to explain why it's...
I remember the purple ammo being such a ball ache compared with the...
Yes.
It doesn't matter. Does Shaq still tell you non-specific nonsense? Is he like, we might just win this?
He does, and Shaq is great. The big problem is Iron Banner is narrated by Saladin.
Oh,
because he's the, like,
yeah.
Technically in Destiny 1 it should have been narrated by Saladin, because the lore pip. The lore is that it's his thing, and Shaq's only oversees the Crucible. and those two don't like each other. And it was a whole situation. And, you know, one of the things that Destiny 2 did was actually have different kind of announcers for the different modes. So Trials has a different announcer as well, because it's not an official Vanguard-approved competition.
Is it Aerith?
Wow. I played a lot of Destiny. I played like 90 hours of Destiny 1, and I don't know what any of this means. I wasn't paying enough attention, clearly, around the... whatchamacallit, the place where you hang out, that bit. What was it
called?
The
tower. Yes. So the problem is, like, yeah, so it's got a different announcer who isn't as good as Shaxx. So it's like, on the one hand, 6v6 is good, but on the other hand, you can only get Shaxx in 4v4.
What? Maybe I'll record him on my phone and play it
to myself. That's what you got to do, yeah, just have a little soundboard.
What was it?
A few more games like this and we might just win this thing.
And you're just kind of like, what thing, Shaxx? What are you talking about?
Okay, well, good.
Crucible Dad's the best.
So is Warmind any good? Have you been playing that?
That's an interesting question that I don't have the answer to yet. Because I played a lot of 6v6, and then 6v6 went away, and Iron Banner went away because it's only a time-limited thing, and then Warmind came out. I played a bit of regular Crucible because they've introduced some new ranking systems. They've got like a quick play mode, which is like the more casual modes, control and just team deathmatch and stuff. They've got a kind of Call of Duty prestige system thing where you just get points whether you win or lose, but you get more points if you win, and if you get multiple wings you get a streak, and then once you hit the top rank you can reset your rank.
Can you get amazing armor that makes you look like you've been upholstered? Because that's always the best thing about prestige and like Call of Duty. You just sort of look at people and go, really?
There are a load of
reward.
There are some ornament, like some armor things that change what your armor looks like for doing prestige stuff, but I can't remember what it actually
shaders,
looks like.
Isn't it, in thingy? It was like, oh, do you want a glow in the dark shader?
Yeah, it's ornaments now. Because the shaders are, that's a whole different system. Okay. It's another community bugbear is how shaders work.
Okay.
Do you have to pay for shaders?
No, but so in
do you know what? You don't have to get into it. It's okay. Say what you're going to
it's
say.
So it's boring.
Yeah. We don't have to go down every, you know, every room. Again, I'm sure Tim's talked about all of this on the US podcast.
You can find it somewhere. Yeah. Read a Reddit thread.
Inevitably, the grudges will be there.
Yes. So, I've talked about with that a bit. Confirmed that, 4v4 Crucible is not as entertaining. And then played the first mission of Warmind, which is fine. You're on Mars, so Mars is back, but it's a snowy bit of Mars. It's got Hive on it, and the Hive are frozen, which just means they've got, like, ice on them, and then they shatter when you shoot them. And it's like, wow, it's been a lot of years playing Destiny with them adding zero new enemy types.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well then.
But yeah, I really don't know what is on the other end of that campaign. I went back and finished the first DLC, in fact, as well, which was Curse of Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like such a wasted opportunity, because they introduced... You go to Mercury in that, which is just a tiny map that you explore. But at the centre of it is this Vex thing that lets them simulate everything.
They've got a quantum computer.
They've basically got a quantum computer that can simulate any scenario, past or future. And they just use that to like have a couple of fairly boring adventures, and it's like, wow, you built a narrative conceit that could have really enabled like a lot of interesting things, or even what a lot of the Destiny community say they want, which is like these kind of repeatable experiences, repeatable modes that you can go into like once a week for good rewards. They could have had this thing create lots of different variations on a similar template, but instead of doing that, they just had a couple of missions that weren't very good.
All right, okay. Well, Destiny then. Destiny seems like it's just always underachieving, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's weird, isn't it? Like, the only time I can recall them like making everyone happy was that year where the first expansion,
The Taken King, came out.
Everyone was happy right around then.
Was it The Taken King is like the second expansion, wasn't it?
That was like the next year.
The Taken King was like the first big expansion, so it was the year one expansion as opposed to the two DLCs like House of Wolves and the Bad Hive one.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
I
think that's the thing though, is like at this point I don't know what their 10-year plan looks like or if it's going to get to there, because like I loved Destiny, I really did, and Destiny 2 just never did it for me. It felt too much like I was starting again for no reason. Like, why would I play Destiny 2 when I still had Destiny 1? But people weren't playing Destiny 1, so I didn't any of them. So it was a bit like, okay, well, I don't know what is here for me. And I was considering going back because of Warmite, because I really loved the Rasputin stuff from the first game. But talking to Tom Senior and Chris Thurston, like it seemed kind of lukewarm from, certainly from Chris's point of view. Like, fine, but like I think if you hadn't bought a season pass, it didn't feel like a
I think that's the problem
to pick up. And I think that's the thing, is I feel like I've been waiting for the reason. And none is forthcoming. So I'll be interested to see if they announce anything more around E3.
Well, I mean, so the rumour is that, like, you know, I can imagine we're coming up to some sort of big expansion, some Taken King style thing, because, you know, that's what year one of Destiny had, was it had this actual proper expansion 1 year after its release that fixed most of its problems and added a bunch of new stuff in. As like you said, that's probably when the community was the happiest, in like a 4 month window after The Taken King was released, before they realised that the live update team that year wasn't really going to be doing much, and the game was going to be stagnant for most of that year, and then that the next big expansion was rubbish.
Yeah, it looked pretty bad. Alright.
Shouldn't be no Destiny fan.
It's complicated stuff.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to a different game?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. These are the two games that I've played now. So I'm going to start with... I'll start with Phoenix Point, actually.
All right.
So,
you can combine the two. Phoenix Point Hospital.
That's a very good point. They do have both have point in the title. Well done, Pip. That's good.
Thanks.
Maybe that's the name of the podcast, Phoenix Point Hospital.
I'll take that under advice.
Yes. okay, good. So, yes, I have been playing the backer build of this, the first one. I think they're releasing a bunch of them. If you back the game on Fig at a $50 tier, then you get access to this. Or if you pre-order the game at, I think, $60. No, it's the other way. It's $40 at the back to back it on Fig.
Right.
$50 if you buy it now. I'm pretty certain that's it. You get access to this. And it's just a small combat demo, really. It's like one fort that you have to liberate from these sort of mutant alien things. In Phoenix Point, the world's been ravaged by this infection that turns all living creatures into this these strange looking, they say Lovecraftian, but they kind of just look like flesh mutants.
Yeah, they're just sort of crab mutants, aren't they?
Yeah, a lot of crab men.
Mutant plus crab, that's pretty Lovecraftian, isn't it? It's just
what if
people but the sea.
And what that becomes in a turn-based XCOM style game is this crab looking man has a little shield and he'll run at you, and whatever way the shield is pointing at you, you try and get behind him and fire on him from there.
Is it the same
sideways?
Is it the same build that we had the Weekender?
I think it's like I don't think it is.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I think it's a different location, just from what I saw.
Because the boss looked familiar, but
yeah, the same boss of like this giant spider lady turns up, and you have to, you know, try
crab
and
spider lady.
Crab spider lady. You have to kill her.
Mm.
And so they, but it's harder than the Weekender demo, I'm told. And that was already quite tricky.
Yeah, that fucked me up.
Yeah. It's really hard, and I haven't finished it. I had 7 attempts before we wrote our preview, and I got pretty close to killing the Spider Queen lady on one of them by I was listening to Tom Senior's advice of like take out the front legs, and then it slows her down because she sort of sprints towards you across the battlefield, and you think you've hidden somewhere, but she knocks shit down as well.
Yeah, that's what really screwed me up. I was like, I thought, oh, I'm gonna do really good and put my people up this big tower.
Yeah,
she just walked into it and was just like, well, that's dead now.
Yeah.
can Tom Senior like win at this?
I don't think he's
like
won
just
yet.
Armchair like advising you from a point of like being.
He
defeated.
Did win the Weekender demo, the easier Weekender demo.
Okay.
He managed to do that apparently. Although Julian Gollop was sat next to him giving him pointers. I didn't have that. I just had, you know, podcast listener Max Ursa watching me.
Did you feel a certain,
my defeat.
Yeah. Do you feel a certain amount of pressure from that?
I didn't know he was there.
You don't want to lose a subscriber by fucking it up.
I didn't know he was there until I finished, and then the game over screen was there, and I was like, oh, shit, there's evidence now.
Yeah, so it's really hard. But like to look superficially, it looks like an XCOM spin-off. Like the UI right now is pretty similar. And I'm fine with that because it means it's very easy to grasp if you've played that. So you have a certain, in the game you have like a point system that the kind of like action points that you can draw upon to perform certain actions, like to go in Overwatch costs one, for example. I think they're called will points, and then there you have about six of them per character, and you can replenish them, that sort of thing, and you can use them to perform special actions like. Like I say, Overwatch. Trying to think of another example. I think maybe there's the run and gun move from XCOM is one of them as well. I'm possibly missing. Using a jetpack.
Yes,
that's it. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Using jetpack, that costs either two or three, I think. And then there are ways you can replenish it by skipping your turn, that sort of thing. And so I don't get much of a sense of how you kind of manage that. Indeed, or how a jetpack is even really useful in that game. Other than if you're surrounded by enemies, you can get out of there. But I never got to a point where I was surrounded by enemies. Usually if two enemies got the drop on me, I was
pretty
much
screwed.
Yeah. So yeah, it's you start across this bridge away from this fort, and then you kind of you get attacked by like three crab men, and then once they're defeated, you can kind of push inside. But after about five or six turns, that's when the Spider Queen will turn up every single time and kind of run behind you to attack you. So you're kind of incentivized to get across that bridge, because if you're too close. If you linger on that side too long, she'll just be so close, and when she arrives, she can just attack you straight away.
Mm.
When she attacks you, it's not a one hit kill, but she'll wipe out all your health and make one of your characters bleed, which means you lose one health per turn. It's difficult stuff. The specific body damage is a big part of what they're kind of selling Phoenix Point on, and the way that shooting is kind of dynamic. So I don't know if you remember in XCOM, one of the little customizable. Sort of things you can put, what would the word be for them? You know, when you start a campaign and it says, turn this on, turn this on.
Oh, modifiers.
Modifiers, yes. Yeah. It's late on a Thursday. I don't remember the words for anything.
Yeah.
I don't remember the words for anything. You know how it's got that all angles one, where like if you get an angled shot, then it affects your chances slightly differently?
Yeah.
This has a kind of more advanced version of that, where getting whatever your specific angle on an enemy, when you open fire, that will impact whether you hit them or not. So in the case of the crabmen, they have this front-facing shield.
Mm.
But to just get one of your guys to the side, that will be enough to land some direct damage on it.
Right,
so,
yeah. Battle takes a bit like that with how his armor system works.
Yeah, and like it's a lot more binary in XCOM. I've not actually played XCOM with that modifier on, but I noticed it when I was playing a campaign. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that's like. But this is the whole thing. Is like the bullets are dynamic, and yeah, the game will respond accordingly. So I lost a whole bunch of times, but in this demo you have no real classes. You've got like a guy with a rocket and stuff like that. You're not part of a faction. There are like three factions in the game, and they each have different abilities, and one is like this strange faction who kind of merge with the mutants, like a kind of your classic Fallout style religious faction of, you know, merging with the mutants to get some of their weird abilities, and yeah, the other ones are different variants. The whole thing is that there are pockets of mankind around, and you can kind of lean towards different ones, so they're kind of like vanilla units basically. But so just to give you an idea of how the combat system works, and already with that, the kind of consideration of angles and body parts, like, you know, taking out like a grenade throwing arm, or like you know, like the thorax. I destroyed the thorax of the Spider Queen, and that made her bleed. Oh god, that's a horrible sentence. And like, but that was the closest I got to killing her, because on each turn she would lose health, and it was kind of like, well, if I can just avoid her for enough time, then she'll bleed out and die.
Do you know what you need? You just need a giant glass and a giant postcard. You can kind of deploy.
I was about to say, oh, I could put some beer in a little half cut out bottle, but I'm thinking of slugs. Yes.
Also, that doesn't work. They just drink your beer. Just go for like a little like kebab run across your vegetable patch afterwards. Like, oh no, I just made them hungry.
Kebab run. Yeah, so that's Phoenix Point. Like, there's not loads more to say at this point, but I do think that those fundamentals make it a bit of a different proposition to XCOM. They tell me there'll be multiple difficulty settings, and I can tell you I'll be playing on easy. This hasn't been balanced, this build, either. The other wrinkle is that you can run out of ammo. You have to find ammo in the world itself. So that can be kind of tricky. Me and Tom went to the same ammo crate, and he got a grenade, and I got like ammo for everything. I didn't know if that was a glitch or not. But
it might be randomised.
Yeah, but it means that like your movements around each level really have to take that into consideration, because after about 7 or 8 turns, I would say that most of your major units will be depleted of ammo. So there you go. There's my thoughts on Phoenix Point so far. But it's so early on. Like, it's I think it's a pre-alpha build,
right, yeah.
And like it's been delayed to 2019 anyway. So it's a long way away. But yeah, it looks nice, and it's very promising. It definitely doesn't just feel like a rip-off of, you know, a thing that Julian Gollop inspired and created. As in the Firaxis XCOM, it's really not the same deal. So
it was.
Yeah.
I think it was one of the busiest stands at the Weekender as well. I would say, like going past, it never had free space when I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll drop by. It was, okay, no, that's still a queue.
Yeah, Julian told me on the Saturday that he kind of wished he'd got more stands there because he didn't realise how popular the game was going to be. It's quite a lengthy demo as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, so it's I'm really enjoying it. It's really cool. Like, and I think this sort of thing is, if you did back it, I'm not much with the sort of crowdfunding campaigns these days after learning my lesson a couple of times, in quite embarrassing ways that I've discussed in this podcast. I think that getting this sort of thing and being able to offer feedback and help find bugs, that sort of thing, probably is quite valuable if you have been a fan of Julian's work for many years. Okay, good. So that's that. And now for another modern take on an old PC genre.
What?
Yeah. So Two Point Hospital. I played this at Sega's HQ. It's like I turned up to the event a day early, which is embarrassing.
What did you do?
So I got to Sega's headquarters in Brentford, and I rang the head of PR and said, hey, I've turned up to your event a day early. He went, oh, how you doing? And I went, mixed fortune, to be honest. I was like, I'm outside your office. And they very kindly accommodated me. I just thought this is a sort of ludicrous rock star style behaviour that is embarrassing coming from a games journalist. Like, hey, I turned up to your event at the wrong time, but you can accommodate me, right?
You must have looked like the biggest Keno.
Yeah.
Like, I really, really want to play this. Let me in.
And the honest truth is, I didn't read the email properly. Yeah, so that was good.
I need to send you the Sesame Street counting video again?
Oh dear. It was. I kind of like thought at least it wasn't an international trip where I turned up to Heathrow a day early, and it was like, okay, right, I've screwed this. So yeah, it was quite funny, really, in a way. And they set it up for me very kindly, and I played the first. I've played like an hour of it, and you basically get this tutorial hospital where it explains how the game works, and then the idea in the game is that you're running a healthcare organisation, not just one hospital, so you're kind of running them all in tandem, although I'm pretty sure that when you're not managing them, the game doesn't like play itself in the background and terrible things happen. They kind of just tick along. Mm. But yeah, and it has like a overcooked, not Overwatch, overcooked style structure where it's like 1, 2, or 3 stars. And 1 star is kind of basic completion of hitting the objectives, and then 2 or 3 stars might be some more abstract extra objectives. So it might be cure a certain illness of a certain type or whatever it might be. But in this tutorial, it was very simple. It was just level up your hospital to like level 7 or something, cure 20 patients, make this amount of money. It's a pretty simple level, so it kind of just keeps ticking along, and that's absolutely fine. But then later ones will have more unusual plots of land, different illnesses will come into it that are difficult to treat, and that sort of thing.
I think they mentioned that environment might play a part. Like, you could be in a really cold area, so you have to pay attention to heating more.
Yes,
or
an icy area as well. Yeah. It's quite out there. It's definitely not, you know, representative of real healthcare. at least not in this country. But yeah, it's very, very familiar. If you like Theme Hospital, I played about 3 hours of Theme Hospital before I went to play this, just for comparison. And like, it's 100% a modern version of that type of game. And yeah, it's not vastly different, but I kind of think that's comforting and nice, because who makes a game like that now? It doesn't really happen. And yeah, and if it was a choice between playing this and Theme Hospital, I'd totally play this.
Yeah.
Because the UI is really nice. You have like about 21 years worth of progress in, you know, how it plays, and being able to spin around a 3D camera is extremely nice. And
just the way at the weekend stage, watching them sort of placing buildings and seeing how that works, just looked like it would be so much better than Theme Hospital's slightly clunky way of doing things.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely feels like the same type of game, though. Like I think they have kind of been making like noises along the lines of, well, it's not just exactly the same, and it's true, because you're managing all these different hospitals in tandem as opposed to moving from one to another. And there's several reasons for that. They wanted to kind of inspire the sense of ownership over a hospital, instead of it just being a thing where you tick it off and move on. If you like a particular location, you can return to it and customize it however you please.
Yeah, it's always been a difficult one for these types of sim games, is do you make it a sandbox where you can just run it for as long as you want? Because usually if you do, you'll eventually hit a point where it's fine. You can't really do anything to screw yourself over.
Or if you've run out of things to spend your money on.
You just sort of hit the limits of its possibility space there.
Yeah.
Or do you do the campaign thing where you hit an objective and just move straight on, and suddenly it's like, well, you can start all over again, and there's no sense of belonging or achievement, really. I mean, you get the achievement of tick, you've completed it, but not of seeing this thing you've crafted sort of turn in. So it's, yeah, I can see that working.
Yeah.
Just knowing they're there somewhere else and being able to go back and...
Yeah, and there's another element to that, which is that whatever research you carry out across hospitals, you can then take back to a previous hospital. And if you're not hitting the objectives of those 2 or 3 stars, maybe what you research and what you can build helps you get there. So you have something, you have a kind of like, yeah, like a kind of, I guess, a persistence between the different hospitals. And yeah, and it kind of like, you are conscious in that sense then of like, well, I've got to make sure this one's up to 3 stars, this one's up to 3 stars, however you want to play it. You can just get up to 1 star and move on, that's fine. But they did suggest that later hospitals could only be unlocked by collecting a certain amount of stars, so we'll see how important that is. But it makes a very good first impression. It's very, very, very cozy to just spring up at a hospital, like put your GP's office, your pharmacy, you know, your reception desk and your drinks machine and all that stuff.
Clear up some vom.
Yeah, there's no vom in this demo, but I did ask about that. There will be some more gross out kind of illnesses.
There will be a vompocalypse at some point.
You get ghosts, you get people die. I had lots of people die in my hospital, but that didn't really seem to affect his reputation too much. And besides, I hired a janitor who could hoover up the ghosts, so that was fine. That was a specialty. I paid extra for a ghost hunting janitor.
Can you not hire Derek Acora to come and make a TV show about ghosts?
He doesn't chat to them, though. He doesn't get rid of the problem. He just makes friends with it.
A popular tourist destination. Roving film crews coming in.
Although they then become the problem, don't they? They're cluttering everything up. You could also like have them filming different things, though, like one born every minute and like maybe an episode of Holby.
This has turned into a different game.
Scrubs, when they bring that back, probably.
Yeah, Grey's Anatomy. Like, just round the corner, it's fine.
You've got to get out of this room. House is coming in soon. There's a schedule to keep.
Not that I'm suggesting this is in a similar vein, but there are going to be, like a Theme Hostel, sort of celebrity type characters who come in, like, you know, VIPs and people you have to please and stuff like that. And emergencies where you have to cure a certain amount of patients in a certain amount of time, that sort of thing. It's all very... It all makes sense as a kind of like logical extension of what Theme Hospital was, and if you made a game like that now, what would it look like? And it is that game, and that I am totally fine with that. A couple of critics were a bit down on that, but I don't know, like, show me another kind of game like this around now.
I think my thing with it is that I don't really like the nostalgia wave, because I just it feels disingenuous, and it also feels a bit like just mining people's memories for money a lot of the time. But this actually feels slightly different to that. I mean, yes, it is theme hospital again, but you know, for you know, with lots of lessons learned and with a slightly different approach to design that sort of backs it up. But I think it's more about the fact that it scratches the same comforting itches that it did back then. It's not really about, like, let me take you back to a time before you had a mortgage. It's kind of...
I still live in that time. Like,
well, same. But it's more... for me, this feels less about, like, let me mine out your childhood for more cash, and more about, like, you know, those things that you enjoyed doing then, they're still fun now, and it's still nice to make a little space that you've designed. And like, it's the reason that I still happily tinker about with The Sims in architecture mode, or whatever the thing that they call it now is. But yes, like, you know, because building spaces is fun, and watching them like tick over is fun, and like, yeah.
I think there's also a bit of a difference when it comes to, like, I mean, you can still play Theme Hospital. It's on GOG. You can just go download it and play it.
Yep.
But
it's still
like
pretty fun.
4 quid, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But it's going to be just that. I think there are enough kind of resistances against using it cleanly. You know, just dealing with its UI, dealing with the things that don't work. It has a lot of balance issues, that game.
Yes,
so
it's
just
very hard
making that thing again, but it takes
to click
into
on
account.
Rats is so difficult.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just doing that, but it takes into account like modern design innovations, and it just feels nice.
And
is fine.
And
frankly,
even in the way it looks, like I spotlight this in my preview that you've probably both read by now.
Mm-hmm.
You would have done, because deadline, the forever deadline. And yeah, it looks beautiful. Like, the animations are nice and specific. If you zoom in on what's going on with the characters, you get some really nice little details when patients are being cured and when they're gesticulating, and or when my janitor is hoovering up a ghost. That animation is lovely. And he has now, it says like he captured the spirit, and you can later use that spirit for research, which sounds really sinister in quite a cool way. Yeah, like it doesn't feel like a cynical rehash,
yeah,
in the way that you would see, I would argue, you see all the time on mobile in like bad pop-up ads with bad like 2002 mobile style avatars as the main characters.
In the way that annoyed me a lot when you know, when Kickstarter was the big thing and adventure games, developers were getting into Kickstarter, and a lot of the pitches would always be like, hey, you used to love this thing, but publishers hate it. But with your help, if you give us lots of money, we can bring it back from the dead. And it's like, if you paid attention to the indie scene, you'd know adventure games have been thriving.
Yeah.
And that really felt cynical and shitty to me, because it was directly targeting the nostalgia, because it wasn't even prepared to acknowledge the idea that actually there is an adventure game scene. It's just, you know, these people were so beholden to the publisher cycle that they couldn't make it themselves. Like,
in this case then, like, you don't think that's
no, I don't think that applies here at all, because, well, I mean, partially because Sega are just funding it anyway. It's just a thing. But also it's it isn't being messaged with the same kind of assumptions or ideas. It is just coming across as, we kind of liked this thing and want to make it again.
Yeah, and we created this by genre. You
and
know,
it feels like there's an audience for it rather than them trying to create their own audience. I think I get what you mean. I'm just expressing it really badly.
I mean, same. So, but in the same, like, Phoenix Point doesn't feel cynical in either. I mean,
I think
there is a way of mining nostalgia, or at least tipping your hat to that nostalgia and bringing those ideas back, that doesn't feel like it's just a play on, you know, people think gaming was better in the 90s.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, yeah.
Something that I just wanted to flag up, because it, I think, chimes with the things that I found interesting in their in the interview I did with them, and that sounded like they came up in the preview that you had, Sam, was that I've actually also been playing Megaquarium, which is Tim Wicksteed's it's basically a theme park management sim, but around aquariums. Mm. So you're building, you know, these different types of fish tank, and you're populating them with different exhibits so that people can come and watch the fish and things. And they're in sort of talking to him about the current sort of plans for the full version of that. You know, this idea of maybe having aquariums that you could possibly go back to once you've unlocked more things, and sort of not throw them to the wayside. And also that charming animation, you know, because if you zoom in far enough, you're actually in the scene and you can just like have a look around and watch the tanks and watch the fish swimming around and stuff. And it's just very sweet and very bright and calming. I find it very calming. So I think if Theme Hospital sounds interesting, that's another thing that is, it's a lot smaller and made by, you know, a single developer, but he also made Big Pharma.
That's perhaps, I'm overlooking that a little bit there.
There's quite a lot of these types of management sims just happening at the moment quietly. Jurassic World will probably be the biggest one that's coming out soon.
Planet Coaster, obviously,
and Planet Coaster's still ticking along.
And I don't know if anyone ever played the Kairosoft games on mobile, like Game Dev Story, or like Hot Spring Story was the best one. Like
I played one of them and
I think I played two of them and they were basically exactly the same.
Yes, they are.
So it was like, okay, well, I've
done. Did they also do the one where you have like a tower block that you're managing, where every floor can do something different?
Oh, right.
Tiny tower.
Oh, maybe.
I don't know.
Anyway.
In any case, those games kind of exist, but like this specific form still feels like its own thing to me. But I saw you playing Mega Aquarium, and I dragged you around
to be like, here's a coral grouper, look at it.
No, it looked really, really nice. It looked cool, and I'm glad this type of game exists. Like, you know, this is a City Skylines thing of just, you know, interest in that kind of game never goes away. It's just having someone make the right version for the current audience, you know.
For the player. I love that there's more variety out there, just because it means that people are more likely to be able to find a one that is for them, right?
I mean, like, tinkering about with a hospital and doing that kind of very specific business management style construction is different from, I want a big T-Rex in a park that will rampage and kill everyone, maybe.
That's the part I'm excited about.
Also, Jeff Goldblum's there.
All right, good. I'm going to be on to the questions now, then, now that I've talked about the two games that have point in the title.
Hot damn.
Okay, left field prediction for E3. That's from Mox.
I don't think left field, the 2000s electronic group, will be there. That's my left field prediction.
Oh, that's rubbish, Phil.
Dad jokes.
I mean, you've been on deadline, though, so I'll
let
it go.
I've already done an all-over this week, so I can't be funny anymore. Some would argue.
Left field predictions. It's complicated, isn't it? But it's not really left field, but I'm almost certain Splinter Cell is going to be announced now after that Walmart leak last week.
That
combined with Sam Fisher being in Ghost Recon Wildlands to remind people he exists 5 years later, that feels like, why would you pay Michael Ironside to just do that as a one-off? That's got to be expensive, right?
I don't know.
I've never tried to rent my client's site, but
maybe we should. Maybe we can get him to do some podcast intros.
That's true. Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Also, the fact that Clint Hocking's there, and like,
I mean, it'd just be nice to let Clint release a game.
It would.
I think that's what I want more than anything. just let him release a game.
Yeah. I don't know. I've no idea how real that Walmart leak is, but did have Rage 2 in it, didn't it?
Some interesting stuff on there for sure. Also, it had Forza Horizon 5, which is like, you're skipping one, guys. But then Microsoft isn't necessarily the most consistent with numbering systems.
That's true. So I suppose there is the people could just be making that stuff up. They might not all be real, you know.
I wouldn't be surprised if we got a Horizon 4.
Yep, that would.
There's
seem,
been some rumors to that effect. There's been some spy pages to that effect. We've been filling that page of the magazine with literally every desperate whispered rumour that appears on the internet.
Again, it's not left field, but like there is also that rumor about the new Fable being made at Playground Games.
Yeah, that was the other one, wasn't it? Yeah.
But that's probably way too early to be E3.
Yeah, even if it's real, yeah, probably won't show you shit. What? All of these are just. Yeah, all of none of these feel left field.
No,
they're all just. What if the dev made the thing?
Yeah. I think weirdly, it just feels like E3 is a sort of big enough vortex of nonsense that it's hard to left field it.
Who will EA's sports person be this year?
I was wondering whether there was a good answer for that. Like, because I quite Ballester. Like it to be an ice dancer, you know? Like someone from, I don't know, like the 90s Russian
curling
figure
Olympic
skating
team
people
or something
that I used to follow. Like Evgeny Plushenko or someone, but I don't think they have any relevant games.
Or like a darts bloke, you know.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Or like, you know, just some other competitive eating or something, you know. Like.
Yeah, I would
or
play
bog,
that EA Sports
bog
game.
Or snorkeling, or. Oh, you'd love it if it was someone from Deadliest Catch or something.
I would
or
enjoy
like,
that, yes.
You know,
I don't know, I think that's a job, it's not really sport.
Yeah. It's a way of life.
There'll be an exec / host that he'll be like, how does it feel to be on the cover of FIFA this year? And he'll go, yes, I love FIFA. How about this guy, huh? Audience, like, shuffles awkwardly. Okay, yeah. This is Anthem. And please welcome BioWare.
Really sad I'm going to be a plane when that conference is happening.
Yes.
Oh.
It's never good, is it, the A1? It's always bad.
No.
Yeah.
I was there the year it was Pelé.
Yeah.
And that felt so much like someone wanted to meet Pelé.
I think I was there that year, wasn't I?
I think
but
so,
I don't even
yeah.
remember. I probably saw Pelé in the flesh and I didn't even care. I did not register at all. I couldn't even remember seeing Pelé. No. And I was definitely at that conference.
I remember
how
sitting
sad
next
is that?
To a man who legit gasped at a, I believe it was just a really good 3D like rendering of Mark Hamill's face on the screen, and it was kind of like it's not even him. And the man just like properly
I remember being there the year that Aaron Paul came on stage for the Need for Speed movie, remember that? Yeah, and like said a thing and then
oh yeah
off. Yeah,
that's the other question, isn't it? Which conference will have the shiniest car?
Definitely Microsoft, because if they got a Forza, then remember when they lifted a car down from the roof,
that
orange car.
That.
Thing is, though, the year that I went, the best conference was Nintendo's like monthly. What's it that just had them all as Muppets?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that was.
It was amazing.
Yeah, Sony always does a good conference because they know that people just want game reveals. And
yeah, they've got better at that. I remember the old Sony conferences being the ones where, without fail, an hour in, they'd look down at the like financial breakdown of the PlayStation or the PSP at the time for the last year, and just to reaffirm you that system was selling really well in Brazil. And it was like, well, okay, you didn't need to take time out of my life to tell me this, but okay.
Yeah.
The Sony conference that I was there for was the one where Sean Murray got up on stage, went to visit a planet that wasn't all that, and then put his controller down and went off, and then at the very end they were like, and Shenmue 3, and everyone lost their like just lost it, and I was sat there like, what's Shenmue 3? This is weird.
It was because it was a conference where they re-revealed The Last Guardian, revealed the Final Fantasy VII remake and Shenmue 3 in the same conference, and someone told me that. I was like, that didn't happen. I thought bullshit, and then I watched it, and you know, we're here now.
We're here now, and we have
no
one
sign
of those things.
Of Shenmue 3 or Final Fantasy 7 remake anywhere on a release schedule.
Hasn't Shenmue 3 just been pushed back?
Yes, to 2019.
Yeah.
Like,
Although the person that I was sat next to was kind of like, what's Shenmue 3? And he was too busy trying to get to the crowdfunding page on his phone. It was just like,
shut up,
Pip! Exactly. It's like,
shut your damn mouth!
I'll deal with you in a moment.
I've got to pledge $60 to this thing, to this pipe dream.
It was a room full of that Fry take my money gif.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay.
Yeah. Well, hey, that was that. But, I guess we haven't got a left field prediction, have we?
I think E3 is too predictable.
It is too predictable, isn't it? There'll be some big games and some big series, and that will be that.
And there will be a lot of blazers.
I tell you what, though, If you remind me, Phil, I will try and mark exactly on Google Maps where I remember that van with the chip burrito.
Yeah, obviously
being.
That is the only thing I care about.
It was really good.
I recommend going to the counter burger chain as well. The custom burgers. They are very good.
Is that the one where you made a mistake by putting too much stuff in one?
I did, yes. Yeah. But then I kind of like functioned as a starter because I had like boiled egg, crushed nuts, kale, four types of cheese and all this stuff. I kind of just like portioned off several of the ingredients, ate that as a mini starter, then enjoyed the boiger.
Okay.
Yeah. It was good.
Hot tips.
Yes. All right, next question. This is
having thoroughly answered that one.
Yeah. If you do play any, what's your favourite point-and-click adventure games? That's from Butts on our Discord channel.
I mean, the ones that I think most fondly of are, like, Grim Fandango and Day of the Tentacle.
I've never played those.
And Simon the Sorcerer 2.
I played Day of the Tentacle, but I didn't like it. Because Andy forced me to do it in a weird way.
So I think I like it, not because I remember how to play it or anything that happened, but because the evil tentacle has somehow in my mind become enmeshed with that sort of squelchy, joyful noise that the magnetic fields use in their song The Luckiest Guy on the Lower
Holy
East
shit,
Side.
That's specific. Holy shit, that
and
is so
that
specific.
That always makes me smile, so I think I've mentally conflated the two things.
Well, I guess Pitts answered the question now.
And I now think that I like that game, even though I can't remember a single thing about it.
Okay.
I mean, I'm glad you took the time to analyse why the things in your brain happen the way they do.
That was good.
I mean, it doesn't really help anyone,
no.
Does it? Like, it doesn't leave you any the wiser. And it doesn't really help with my credibility on this podcast.
I think that's fine, Pip.
I mean, thank God that's not one of my watchwords.
I didn't really have adventure games when I was a kid, when the LucasArts ones were big. Like, my I had Escape from Monkey Island for a while, the last one, and that's actually, I thought that was really good, but I'm told that's the worst one by far, even though I thought it was really funny and the voice acting was good and it looked quite nice. But yeah, otherwise I kind of passed me by, and I always meant to play the remasters and the ones owned on GOG. I always meant to play the Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis one, because I heard that was good and there was a different ways you could play it, and it was Indiana Jones, which is kind of cool.
It was kind of the age when I only really had access to PC games via the demo discs on the magazine that my dad would sometimes bring home, and so my experience of, for example, Simon the Sorcerer 2 wasn't exactly the full game. It was that chunk that was on the free CD.
Yes.
And that me and my brother and sister would just play over and over, like,
yeah,
together.
That's the same with me and Grim Fandango, actually. I think I had that on a PC Gamer demo disc, and I just played that over and over again. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we would just end up with all this stuff in our inventory that you couldn't use because you didn't have the part of the game where you would actually use it. So it was, I think, about a year or so later we actually got the game, and like then it was just like, oh, that's what that peg is for.
Maybe this is one we can make Andy answer and sort of draft him in like we did in the last podcast.
Yeah, only if we release the podcast next week when he's back in the country.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yes. I think he quite enjoyed Thimbleweed Park, didn't he?
I think he did, yeah. I also agree with him about how good certainly some of the earlier Wadget Eye adventures were, including the Blackwell. I guess there's four of them now, so it's not really a trilogy.
Yeah.
And one called The Shiva, which is about a rabbi. Investigating a mystery that I thought was good.
Quite different. So many good things about that.
Yeah, I mean,
seemed tonally very different.
Yeah, both of them like are more about, you know, specifically, you know, they've got like fantastical elements, but they are about like a real world place, and they really get a sense of atmosphere and sort of noir mystery about them. Pretty well
What's
done.
The Charnel House trilogy, there's one game from that I really liked about being on a train, and it's a point and click but a modern one, and it ended up being part of these three, like, yeah, part of a trilogy, but I can't remember what was it called. Anyway, that has a really good sort of sense of place, and sort of just that slight sort of spooky unsettlingness that you get with short stories sometimes that I quite liked.
Okay.
Like, not horror, but just kind of creepy.
but you can't remember the name of that specific game.
New.
I can just read out the Shinehouse House Trilogy game names to you until you get it. So there is... Oh.
It looks like it's Exhale. That's the one on... Oh, no, there's a couple on a train. Looks like there are multiple train ones. Inhale, Sepulchre.
Sepulchre, yeah.
Yeah, and it's Exhale. One. Okay, so
it's the middle one, basically.
Middle one.
Okay.
Because I think they released the middle one first, maybe? I can't remember, but... And I think overall I wasn't keen on the trilogy prospect, but
right.
I liked the middle part.
Yes.
It's good.
Okay. In terms of point-and-click adventures, I can say I have played most of Westwood's Blade Runner. I've played about 5 or 6 hours of that. That's pretty good as an extension of that universe. I played it long after.
Right, yeah.
I've seen the film as an adult, but yeah, that's pretty cool.
I mean, I remember enjoying The Longest Journey when I played that, although I played it with a guide because, you know, who's got the time to deal with that fucking rubber duck puzzle.
Does Fahrenheit count as a... I don't really like Fahrenheit that much, actually.
I don't know. Well, yeah, it's not great.
It's an emotional romance.
I guess, like jazz punk. That's kind of like an extension of...
Yeah, I was, like, there's this sort of adventure strand that kind of builds off of point and click, but doesn't really feature the elements of pointing or clicking as much. And like, things like Oxenfree that I thought was really good.
Yeah, I really like that. Yeah.
But it's not really a puzzle game in the way that people think of, I think, when they say point and click specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah, Oxenfree reminded me more of things like Welcome to Night Vale or, you know, that kind of, again, that kind of creepy short story-ish vibe,
which was
really nice.
I guess sort of adventure games that are specifically about the kind of story and the characterization more than having puzzles that block your progress. And
I really enjoy playing Dark Side Detective, actually. That's a good, it's very simple, straightforward, you know, you're a detective, there are some like fun supernatural mysteries, it's kind of like a BBC show from the 90s or something. It's just sort of fun. Yeah. There are two characters, a foil and a, you know, it's very familiar.
I keep
meaning
to play that because I think the first episode was originally like a free game or whatever, the first chapter or whatever it is,
I
really enjoyed that.
It's been like a moderate success. I think it's been like, you know, found an audience. It's on Switch as well, so yeah, it's good. I suppose we do have answers to that question, but like the real dyed in the wool ones, I've played one of the Broken Sword games, 3, which is not a very good one.
I played the first one, it was right.
Yeah, I've always meant to play them to, you know, develop a closer bond with Andy, but I never quite got around to it. So we've always remained at slightly
distant.
Problem
with a lot of like, classic ones, whenever I play them, I'm like, yeah, I can see why people liked this at the time.
Yeah,
but
that's it.
They've never really kind of penetrated me. It's, you know, while playing them, that's always been like, okay, yeah, like intellectually I can see why this would be good for somebody. Yeah.
I wonder whether it's so for me they always seem just slightly too slow, like that there's humor there, but it's delivered in such a kind of obtuse way often. And I think that because I don't naturally enjoy that you know, the repetitive or experimental nature of a lot of the repetition, especially in the worst ones, that combining different things with different things, it's kind of like, okay, whereas I can get the hit of that humour or that insight into someone by, you know, listening to interviews that other people have done or podcasts, like gaming themed or otherwise.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that, like that improved access in a way to the actual source and to those people's humour or their nods to camera almost is kind of, that's where I can get that without having to figure out what to combine with a door.
Yeah.
I assume, if a person is just talking about what they're doing and doing it in a funny way, then you get the sort of the inherent sense of comedy timing that they might imbue into their work. But that is really, I think adventures, comedy adventure games in particular must struggle like with pacing a joke, because a lot of them, you know, you click the thing on the thing and then there's a like a split second pause and then it locks into like the animation or it locks you in for a second while it delivers a joke at you. And it's not really, I think jazz punk's really good because it lets you
dictate the time.
It lets you actually take part in the punchline in a way that shows a lot of trust in you being able to make a thing funny for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you get, you know, if you are experimenting with different objects or whatever, then you get like the hit of humour when you first do it, but then you've forgotten which ones you've tried, and then you go through them again, and then you sort of hear the same lines again, and it starts to fall flat. And maybe that just, I mean, obviously I know that I'm not the audience for this stuff, certainly not anymore, but I think that there is appeal there, but that I can access it more directly through other things.
Yeah, I'd probably watch Grim Fandango if it was like a, you know, like a CG film or an animation or something like that on Netflix or whatever. Like, you know, like those sort of universes.
That would be lovely, actually.
There's no reason like Monkey Island, Full Throttle couldn't all become that. Like people like Adult Swim stuff, and that's not really a million miles away from that type of humour.
No,
I don't know.
I think Grim Fandango would really hold up to that as well.
Yeah.
Such a lovely game. Full Throttle. I wouldn't have to do the 3D like navigation.
Full Throttle has like an arc and everything. Like it's all there. Anyway, yeah, it was a good rambly chat. That now we're about to enter some peak pit territory.
Oh God.
If you could hire a celebrity to write for PC Gamer, who would it be, and what do they write about? That's from Ribbus Prison on Twitter. Thank you. Go, Pip, go.
Well, this is the thing, because do you just want me to list out, like, pantomime stars? Sean Williamson, Barry off EastEnders.
What would he write about?
Anything.
He would write about Euro Truck Simulator.
Why not?
Yeah. Who would be the best people to write about Euro Truck Simulator? You can get anyone to write about their experience playing that game.
Somebody, like, super flamboyant and, you know, somebody that is just larger than life, kind of. Everything they do is completely unusual. And I can't think of anyone because I don't really know what celebrities are these days. But let's get them. I don't want to just get a famous truck driver, if even such a thing
exists. Maybe you could get that, like, someone from, I don't know, the Real Housewives series is to go on a road trip in Euro Truck,
or you get like
or an American truck.
Because like, if your life is consistently exciting and. Maybe get one of the Kardashians or something, you know. Very exciting life, presumably. Well, not much in charge of. Not, you know, who knows how much like relationship with actual reality is there.
Yeah.
Just sit him down in front of the M25 for a bit.
Okay. I've got...
That's interesting, because like, the Kardashians weren't on my list.
Interesting.
Mm.
I think it's just too obvious, isn't it, Pip, for
you? Also that I think
it's like shooting fish in a barrel, really.
Of all of the reasons that I find various Kardashians and Kardashian satellite structures interesting.
It's like Game of Thrones, really.
It's not because of their editorial output.
A lot of these things are going to need sub-editing.
Oh, for sure. But I think that, okay, so my thought on this is that you don't want an A-lister. You want somebody from the C to Z tiers who is, because there's just, in general, like a less guardedness. Like from when I used to do celebrity interviewing and things, the people who were really free with what they would say, and it was, you know, for better or worse sometimes, but also could be really entertaining and heartfelt, was the people from, for example, Big Brother or Survivor or whatever else, because, you know, it was, they had media training and clearly like had ideas of how they wanted to present themselves, but it wasn't in the same sort of polished or sort of highly filtered and approved way that you would get with the higher tiers of things. And so I would say that you would genuinely get like more engaging content from someone maybe lower down, but who, you know, had that spark, right?
Yeah, or you could get Simon Pegg to play Peggle and write about it. That's counter suggestion.
Just an alternate of the idea where you wanted me to play that PUBG map because it was called Savage.
Why is that a bad idea? Explain why that is a bad idea.
So I was actually, because I was trying to construct how I'd do that, and it was like, well, okay, when reviewing a pub, you can just point to the things that make a pub like successful, and review it based on that. Much like when Pip reviewed a dog, you just, you know, you identify the traits of a dog that make it a good dog.
Yes.
And then you can go. But I'm not sure I was prepared to like identify the traits of the savage.
Yeah. The word savage gets used quite a lot in games as well, doesn't it?
It does.
Like, it's like, yeah, it, I can see why you struggle to extrapolate meaning, but what can I say, Phil? You reviewed a pub once, you know?
I think, as well, I would just quite like to meet some people, you know? Like, I think under the spurious, you know, could you review the weather in this game, Carol Kirkwood off BBC Breakfast Weather? Like, I just want to hang out with her for a while, have a chat.
I'm trying to think of, like, have I ever met a celebrity off the back of, like, writing about games? I'm trying to think if I have. I remember, like, I used to work for Play magazine when that was a thing, and then what they once interviewed Eminem when Driver came out, because I think they just paid Eminem to, like, promote it. And so there was an interview with, yeah, there was like a spread about Driver, and then they were chatting to Eminem about, oh yeah, how has your music changed over the years and stuff, and it's like, why is this even a thing? They interviewed Michael Owen once for World League Soccer as well, like a bad game that he promoted back in the day, and you know, he's not very interesting, Michael Owen, so the answers were kind of anodyne. But yeah, I don't know, has that ever happened to you? I'm trying to think of any celebrities I've met off the back of this. I'm sure I have, I just can't remember them. Pip, were you not near celebrities at some kind of bash? I know that was when you were working in more in celebrity
so
culture, wasn't it?
In weird ways, I can absolutely OP the hell out of this, because yeah, like, that used to legit be my job.
Yeah.
But I think in the video game sphere, I mean, like, things like Call of Duty launch events,
yeah, I guess
where
launch
they
events
just sort of, they used to invite a lot of people from like Chelsea Football Club and The Only Way Is Essex.
Yes.
So you'd sort of see, I don't know, Jess Wright or someone.
Right.
And that's why I reviewed, that's why you guys sent me to the Call of Duty Ghosts one?
Yeah,
that
was Ghosts was the dark one. Yeah.
And it was because I was the only person that you thought would know who anyone was.
Yeah.
It was like, we're not going to know. So, okay. And I ended up just getting distracted by the dog and talking about the dog. So
that's fair enough.
That was fine.
I actually have, and I've interviewed a couple I remember now. Mm. I interviewed John C. Reilly when Wreck-It Ralph came out. He wasn't very nice to me.
Really?
No, he wasn't very nice to me. And then I also met Sam Witwer, who was the guy who played Starkiller in the Force Unleashed games. And he was really handsome. And they asked, do you want a picture with Sam? And I was like, no thanks, because I don't want to be next to someone who's that much better looking than me, because it won't be good for my self-esteem. Also, I think there's something slightly embarrassing about people, games journalists, like meeting sort of celebs associated with their work and then happening on Facebook or whatever. Like,
I've met a lot of esports people that world would probably be impressed by, but it really doesn't translate to anything else. It's basically like, I've met Faker, everyone else looks at you blankly.
Yeah.
Like, three people go, ooh.
Yeah, that's not gonna know who that is. It's, I guess, like, now you only get to meet celebrities if, you know, you're gonna do some YouTube bands off the back of it, it seems like.
Oh yeah, right, yeah, the whole, yeah.
Because, well, Chris went to do that Star Citizen thing, didn't he?
Oh, he did legit meet the Hamels.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so
I mean, that guy who was sat next to you at E3 would have lost his shit. An actual Hamel in the room.
But yeah, I think that it's so few and far between, because even if someone's doing voice work, it's not like they tend to get pushed onto the trail of PR or publicity stuff.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, a film red carpet, like, you know, they're contractually obliged to trot round the globe, whereas, you know, even if someone has lent their voice, they're not going to trot round and meet up with you. Or
one exception is Troy Baker for Arkham Origins. Is that what it's called, that one? Yeah,
sure.
The 2013 one that Rocksteady didn't make, he was on tour because he voiced the Joker in it, and he was very handsome for a voice actor. You know, I expect voice actors to look more like me, but he looked amazing. He looked like Bradley Cooper, but a voice actor, and I was like, holy shit, what a handsome man.
He's more in the sort of game sphere, though, I guess, so maybe it makes more sense, like,
did you say
perhaps
that
there's a reason.
You could be a face actor.
Amazing. I did point out how handsome he was. It was probably quite embarrassing. But yeah, I think he was also there for like MCM Expo or something. But it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, it's like probably easier to get like a Troy Baker to do your press tour than it is to get a Mark Hamill, who was in, you know, the Joker in every other Batman game.
The most embarrassing thing I've done with a gaming celebrity is like, this is quite, not quite it's quite counts as celebrity, but I mean, the voice of Solid Snake did do the voice for me while I was interviewing him, and I nearly shat myself. I also
were you in the office at the time?
No, I was okay, at home. I was at home, and yeah, it was very exciting. He's very nice, David Hayter. He's good. There was it was the guy who played Tidus in Final Fantasy X. I told him he voiced Obi-Wan in the Clone Wars cartoon, and I told him that I played 400 hours of Final Fantasy X. He went, "God bless you." Okay, we've gone way off the question here, but I thought that story was worth telling. It was quite embarrassing. Why did I tell him that? What was I thinking? Why did I tell him that? That's so embarrassing. Yeah, so that was me in 2010. Anyway, let's talk
that's
about
the most you've ever been condescended to.
No, he was very nice. He was very, very nice.
Did he pinch your cheeks?
You, a 22-year-old man. Yes. So that very much brings us to the end of the podcast, I think.
I think so.
I think we've Friday'd this enough for a Thursday podcast. So, yes, thank you very much for listening. If you want to send us some questions, you can do that at PC Gamer Pod. Just send us a tweet and I'll pick it up in the tweet deck thread when people aren't tweeting bullshit at us about, oh, why haven't you investigated this? They nerfed my favourite weapon in this MMO no one plays. Why aren't you looking into this?
So the last round of Twitter questions didn't go well then.
No, it's actually fine. There's only one guy who did that, but it was nonetheless, you know.
Well, that's... I hope you feel really called out, guy.
He definitely doesn't listen to the podcast. I think he just sent out an alert to anyone with PC in their Twitter handle, and
I'm
we
so
were swept up
no
at that.
Longer on Twitter right now.
That's very wise, Pip. You're missing nothing. You're missing people arguing about Yanni and Laurel, and people retweeting Deadpool 2 marketing. It's a fucking wasteland. And good for you, frankly.
Or you can email us.
Yes,
letters at PCGamer.com. Let me tell you about the pricks in my inbox.
If it starts with "what if" but blockchain, just don't.
And those are the, you can also, if you're a member of the PC Gamer Club, drop into the Discord and ask us a question there.
Yeah, we're nice to those people. So
we're nice to everyone. Just, you know, we don't ever call people out specifically. I mean, I called Michael Owen boring, but, you know, Greg, yes. So, yeah, those are all the ways you can contact us. We'd welcome to hear your questions. We'll be back almost certainly in 2 weeks when we've played some more games that we can talk about.
Yeah,
that sounds about right. Maybe around E3, before, after.
Yes, there will probably be some things in the next few weeks that we can discuss before then.
Yeah.
Okay. And also just put the PC Gaming Show from E3 in your calendars also, maybe.
Yes.
I don't know when.
Absolutely. And there'll be a new issue out of the magazine out.
Yes, on May 31st, maybe, depending on if this deadline ever ends.
Yes, it's Monday, June the 11th for the PC Gaming Show, I believe. Cool. So yes, thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back soon.